Philly ETE Podcast Number 9, Linda Rising, Deception and Estimation, and How We Fool Ourselves. Hi, I'm Ken Rimple. Welcome to the show. Today we have Linda Rising with her talk on deception and estimation. She holds a PhD from Arizona State University in the area of object-based design metrics. Also, she has a background in university teaching and work in a variety of industries such as telecommunications, avionics, and strategic weapons systems. She's an internationally known presenter and author of articles and 4 books, including Design Patterns and Communications, The Patterns Almanac 2000, and her latest book with Mary Lynn Manns, Fearless Change, Patterns for Introducing New Ideas. We really enjoyed producing this talk. It's a lot of fun, so enjoy.
There are seats up in front. You're not sure whether you want to stay. I understand that. This is going to be a difficult talk. So maybe I should tell you a little bit about what the talk is about, so it's not too late if you want to move somewhere else. This is about deception. Do I need to define that? I find that when I travel to different parts of the world, it translates differently. So I'm assuming most of you are English speakers. This is Philadelphia. Okay. English speakers. Deception. What does that mean? Well, I think lying is a bit harsh, but yeah, to deceive.
Marketing.
That's also a bit harsh. So this is about lying or deceiving and what it has to do with estimation. So I have taken it upon myself, it's my mission in life now, to help you who don't have enough time to learn about your brain. There's an enormous amount of information out there now, and it's something we should be paying attention to because we make a lot of assumptions about the way we are and the way our brains work. And on the basis of those assumptions, we decide how to work and how to live. And it turns out that most of those assumptions are false. So I'm here to give you some bad news. And so I'm going to apologize for that up front. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to tell you some bad things about yourself and about the way you are, but to assure you that there's nothing you can do about it, so you don't need to feel bad. The other thing that I might add, and I'm going to start with a disclaimer, I hope, maybe not. Well, we'll see. I'm going to start with a disclaimer. This is a topic I've been interested in for the last 10 or 15 years, which, given my lifespan, is a very short period of time. So I'm not an expert in the brain. I have a PhD in computer science, and I've always been a technical person. So some of this information, even though disturbing, if it makes you feel uncomfortable, you can explain it away by saying, perhaps Linda doesn't really know what she's talking about. And that's okay. In fact, a lot of the information that I'm about to give you, you will want to explain away because it will be too difficult for you to absorb. My husband says, you know, one of the reasons why you give these weird talks, you're trying to convince yourself. I don't want to believe it either. So this isn't an academic presentation. I don't have citations or references. But I know that some of you will walk out of here feeling that perhaps you'd like to know a little more about it. And I'd be happy to send you some pointers, some places to start, if you'd like to read a little bit more about your brain and how it works. So please feel free to send me a request for that. So here's my definition of deception. Consciously, wait a minute, what is that? Conscious. What's that mean to you? Awareness, yes. It's the part of us that we think has to do with most of what we are about. It's what we consciously do that we're aware of. Now, the other piece of this unconsciously turns out to be the most important and probably the biggest part of what we are all about, and it is inaccessible. If we knew a way to get a hold of everything that our unconscious knows, we'd be much more powerful, not only in solving all the complicated problems we have to deal with, but in also understanding how we work, how people are. So consciously, meaning you would be aware of it, or unconsciously, meaning you wouldn't, you're trying to get someone, and that someone could be you. You're deceiving yourself to believe something that is not true. So I like to begin with the message is, we do this all the time. In fact, it keeps us very busy. 24/7. We're deceiving ourselves, consciously or unconsciously, and we're deceiving others. Can you see? Remember the topic we're talking about, estimation. Can you see how that would get in the way of estimation? If we are deceiving ourselves about, well, lots of things. So, you know, there are people whose job it is to collect a lot of data. This is their job. People who work for large insurance companies collect data about, well, how long we're going to live. Given a set of parameters, how old are you? What's your family history? What diseases have you had? Hospitalizations, surgeries. Given all of that information, they do a pretty good job of predicting how long you're going to live. You know, what is that insurance thing? You know, it's like placing a bet to say, no, I'm going to die sooner. Well, I don't know. I don't sell insurance. But when we are presented with all of that data by professionals who do this for a living, we look at those numbers and we always say, oh, no. I'm going to live, and the number turns out to be between 10 and 13. I'm going to live 10 or 13 years longer than that. And in fact, those of us who are really old, I'm going to look around the room here. I think probably I'm the oldest person in the room, no doubt. And I don't know about you, but I'm at least 20 years younger than my actual age. And I get that because I hang around with people who are 20 years younger than I am, or even younger, people like Brian up here. So it distorts our point of view. In fact, I just read a really interesting paper. How many of you are married? How many of you are married to someone who is, 5 to 10 years younger or older? Okay, quite a few, actually. So here's the data for couples who are in that situation. And I won't ask you which you are. The older partner in the couple will live longer than the actuarial data predict, and the younger will die sooner. So that ties into the other statistic. For those of you who are married, when you did that, well, it was a big decision deciding to get married. Did you go through an analysis deciding, well, I need to do some estimation here. Let's look at risk. What did the data tell us about getting married? And of course, we all did the same thing by saying, oh, that data does not apply to me. I know I've made the right choice. Did you do that? I have a good friend who's been married 5 times. And every time I've asked her, Susan, how is it that you know that this is the right one? And she has always said 5 times now, oh, I just know. I just know. Does that sound like any software projects? How do we know? How do we know this time? Well, this time will be different. I just know. So what the cognitive scientists tell us is that, you know, we wouldn't have moved out of the savannah if we hadn't been very optimistic. I used to think that was a characteristic of software engineers. Turns out it's a characteristic of all of us. Optimism allowed us to be here today. If our ancestors hadn't been optimistic, if they'd been realistic risk estimators, they would never have gone out to fight the saber-toothed tiger or to investigate new areas. They would have stayed at home where it was much safer. Instead, they deluded themselves. And they took a little step forward. A lot of risk. But it's why we're here today. The next sentence is one of the difficult things for all of us. We're not only hardwired to be optimistic, but part of that deception is that we see what we want to see. So basically what that means is that we believe, and I know that since you're all smart people, wait, let's take a poll here. How many smart people do we have in the room? Yes, at least one, two, three, many, many smart people. And so along with that feeling of smartness comes the illusion of rationality. I'm a smart person. Therefore, I'm rational. Did you take that step? I'm smart, therefore I'm rational. I make my decisions. Where are all of you who were married? Was that rational? Is that a rational decision? Did you make a little decision table where you listed the attributes and weighted them and then performed some mathematical operations and summed the results and then you decided, this is the right one for me. Did you do that? I've actually seen, yes, there's always at least one. Yes. Yes. So maybe you are the rational person in the room. Turns out that we are not rational. I'm sorry. In fact, what we do is And we are very good at this, is that when the decision has been made, we're good at rationalizing. At the end of the day, we can give a rational argument for anything that we've done. That's something where smart people are very talented. But the decision itself, and what got us to the place we are, it's not rational at all. And in fact, the reason, if there is a reason, for whatever it is that we decided to do, whether it was that choice of a marriage partner or something else, like an estimation for a piece of a project, was done unconsciously. And so we don't even know why we decided to do those things that we decided to do. And of course, it's not the nature of this talk. It's another one that I give. We believe that we are not only rational, but not biased. No, not me. I'm not prejudiced. I would never discriminate against someone on the basis of sex or race or religion or political belief. I'm as open as I can possibly be. I truly believe that. So if you're one of those who subscribes to openness, you might go out to the Harvard University site where they will do a little test and show you exactly where your biases are. And it turns out that we all have them. In fact, I have a very good friend who is African-American who took that test, who learned that he was biased against African-Americans. Oh, no. Oh, no. Not scientists. No. Scientists, we know, are held up as examples of rationality. Surely, surely science knows the way. Surely scientists are not biased. That's what we all believe in, isn't it? The progress of science based on the scientific method. Propose an hypothesis. Test it. Either the test will show that the hypothesis is true or not. What could be more rational than that? Turns out that very, very smart people like scientists are even more biased because they are so smart. There are so many stories. This is one of my favorites because Bob Martin told it at an Agile conference, and Bob Martin tells great stories. So this is a story about someone with a very unusual name, Ignaz Semmelweis. He's a Viennese physician who noticed in the mid-1800s that women in hospitals treated by physicians were dying at astonishingly rapid rates compared to women who simply stayed at home and were being assisted by midwives. What could the difference be? So he began to approach it in a scientific, a rational fashion, and he made some observations, and he discovered to his horror that doctors were going from performing autopsies. You do that on dead people. To delivering babies. And on the way, they never stopped to wash their hands. And in fact, in many cases, their hands would still be bloody or covered with various other things, and would then infect the women who died. So he tested his hypothesis, and he suggested that some doctors would try washing their hands in a solution of bleach, and he noticed women stopped dying. Surely that's convincing. Surely that's enough. Physicians are interested in saving lives, are they not? Surely physicians or scientists, they would believe that this test had shown them a better way. Wouldn't they have immediately embraced this? Wouldn't they have said, oh, yippee. Here's a way to save lives, and it doesn't involve a lot of effort on my part, so I will sign up to do that. What do you think? Did they do it? No. Semmelweis died in an insane asylum at the age of 47. Wasn't until years later, decades later, that someone happened upon the idea that there were little tiny things called germs and that that could be involved in the transmission of material from an autopsy to a woman in labor and would make the difference whether she survived or not. I like this quote from Max. A new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die. And a new generation grows up that is familiar with it. So for those of you who are students of the Old Testament, and you know the children of Israel took 40 years to cross the desert. It doesn't take 40 years to cross the desert. It takes 40 years for the old generation that had grown up in an old paradigm to die. And the new generation to appear in a new paradigm. Wait, all of you are now beginning to think, well, she's talking about other people. She's not talking about me. So here's an experiment. In the experiment, the group of subjects were given some information about someone who was applying for a job. Are any of you ever in that position of having to decide to hire someone? Would that be you? Yeah. And on the basis of something that appears in a resume, you might bring them in for an interview. Maybe the team interviews them. Yeah. So you look at what could be considered objective information. What kind of experience does this person have? What kind of degree from what institution? That's all rational stuff, isn't it? And you evaluate that rationally. So in this experiment, the information about the potential employee was given in two ways. The first way, all of the positive things were given first. In the second way, for a different group of participants, the negative information was given first, but it was the same information. Now, surely, that wouldn't make any difference, would it? No, of course not. Well, then why am I giving you this example? Clearly, it did make a difference. Those who got the positive information first were much more likely to say, oh yeah, I'll bring this person in for an interview. Whereas those who got the negative information first said, well, no, I don't think so. So think about what you do all day. Do you ever begin the approach to solving any complicated problem with all the information that you need? Almost never, right? Does it make a difference in the kind of solution that you develop for that problem? In the way you think about that problem? The order in which that information is made known to you, could that possibly make a difference in how you think about it? Oh, wait, not you. Not you. You're the rational people. These subjects in these experiments, who are they? Where do they get these people? You know, one of the things that we can learn from psychology is that they do real experiments. Whereas in our industry, we do not. We cannot call ourselves engineering. It's not based on science. In fact, last year at the Agile Conference, I gave a talk that said, I think that mostly what runs this industry is what you might call the placebo effect. Think about if drug testing were done the way that we decide to do anything in software development. We bring in a bunch of pills and we say, oh, well, look at this one. It's blue. Oh, I love blue. And it has a nice shape. Oh, my goodness, it's kind of hexagonal. Hexagonal things have always had a special place in my heart. I think these hexagonal blue ones will be very powerful in solving the problem of this disease. Oh, yeah, let's go with the hexagonal. And since I believe in it, it will work. And then I'll give it to all my friends. And I will tell them, oh, yeah, this is it. This little hexagonal blue one. It will solve all your problems. And I'll convince them. I'll be so excited. I will say, yes, my team tried it, and we really liked it. So your team should try it. You'll really like it, too. And that's how we run projects. There's certainly no double-blind controlled experiments. Is Agile any good? Oh, yeah, it is. There's so much excitement and so much buzz, and everybody seems to think so. So the people who got the positive information, it did make a difference for those people. And then they tried a variation on the experiment where they made the decision-making process a little bit pressured. They asked them to do something at the same time. They gave them a little test that they had to do first that was impossible, a little puzzle they had to solve. They tried, in other words, to create a lot of stress. Now, how many of you are asked to produce an estimate under stress? Anybody? Anybody at all? Or do they come in and they say, hey, no problem. Take your time. We want to make sure that this estimate is really good. So take all the time you need. Do all the analysis. Think carefully. My experience is that they lock people in a room and they say, we want you to tell us how you're going to get this done by June. Well, but that's probably a distorted view. You probably have never had that experience. So the psychologists tell us that in an average conversation, how many of those have you had in the last couple of days? There are three lies in every 10 minutes. So let's see, how long have I been talking? And an interesting sort of Pareto result comes out of asking people, are you above average? So let's just do another poll here. How many people here are above average? Most of you, yes, of course. Statistically, we know that's impossible, but you're exceptional. There was an interesting variation of this 80-20 that came from a study in Sweden where they said, are you an above-average driver? 80% said yes. And some of those people who said yes were in hospital having suffered an automobile accident as a result of their own negligence and still said, oh yes, I am above average. Do you remember that little normal curve? Remember how many people could be above average? Yeah, it's okay. Good. Just want to make sure that. All right. So, and smarter people, of course, exaggerate this. Instead of the 80-20, you'll notice college professors, 93% believe they are above average. And of course, now the psychologists have a fertile field of investigation. They are looking at online dating. I'm not going to take a little poll here, but the population of those who are involved in online dating is very interesting. It's large enough now so that they can see some strange differences. The people who are involved in online dating are younger than the normal population. And they weigh less. And they're more educated. And they're into extreme sports. Of course, maybe that's just the way online dating is. It draws in those exceptional people. Yeah. I have another friend who has been experimenting with online dating. She never uses her own photo. In fact, she will change periodically to introduce a new photo. I said, all right. So, even lawyers. So there is advice for lawyers. I could even take that as well. Any lawyers in the room? Hey, yeah. In case you're interested in jury selection. So the interesting thing about this particular document is that it assumes that you can tell by a person's behavior or the way they're sitting. Brian's got his hat on his knee here. You can tell whether someone is lying or not, intentionally deceiving. And what the cognitive scientists tell us is that that is not true. The best way to tell whether someone is lying or not is to look at the words that person is saying apart from their appearance or the tone of voice they are using. Interesting. Well, lawyers sometimes get it right. Maybe. We teach it to our children at Christmas time or birthdays. Well, tell Aunt Martha you really love the present that she gave you and write a little thank you note or send an email or call her up and tell her that you really love this present that she gave you. Be nice to Grandma. She might not be with us long. Give her a hug. Tell her you love her. And you know, this is social deception. It's what holds society together. The fabric of society would unroll if we were totally honest. Those of you who are married, has your spouse ever come into the room and said, I just bought this new outfit? Do you think it makes me look fat? Well, what do you say? Careful. Be very careful. The biggest part of our brain that's devoted to the input and processing of any sense is the part that's devoted to vision. And even there, where we have enormous resources, we get it wrong in our estimates. We have a bias against width toward height. Even professional bartenders will make this mistake. Given two glasses, you'll notice the one on the right is taller than the one on the left, and so we are deceived by that illusion, and we'll say the glass on the right holds more, when in this example they are holding exactly the same amount. So even things that we see, this is another illusion. We know there are lots of illusions that we estimate that the vertical line is longer than the horizontal line, even though they are exactly the same length. I was going to ask somebody to come up and measure that. And of course, for any of those of you who struggle with eating, we're supposed to have some sort of monitor, an appetite controller that tells us when we're hungry and how much to eat and when to stop. How's that working for you? So what the research scientists tell us is that, and if you struggle with eating, my nemesis is dark chocolate peanut M&Ms. So if there's a bowl of dark chocolate covered peanut M&Ms on the table, I have to remember that the research scientists tell us that I'm going to eat 2 to 10 times more than if that bowl is simply moved into another room. Now, where is that controller? Where's that part of my body that estimates how many calories I've had to tell me, no, wait, Linda, you can't have any more dark chocolate peanut M&Ms. Where's my estimation talent in deciding how many of those to eat when I'm influenced by simply the distance that I have to travel in order to eat those M&Ms? And of course, we all know that if it's all you can eat, we will definitely eat more. Now, here's the scary thing for most of us who sit during the day. We are hardwired to move. Our Stone Age ancestors walked 12 to 15 miles a day. And so sitting instead upsets that mechanism that helps us estimate how much we should eat, when we should eat. In fact, that little estimator is almost 180 degrees off. The longer we sit all day, the hungrier we get. It's a little hormone called ghrelin, and it increases if you're sedentary. And so you really feel hungry, even though you haven't done anything. You haven't burned off enough calories, but you're hungry. And so you say, well, I must be hungry. It's time to eat now. And so you do. So your internal estimator, even for things that are necessary for survival, aren't working properly given the way we live our lives. What happened on 9/11? We sat in front of the television set. I know that I was in an airport. I never got off the ground, but when I got home, this is what people all over the country were looking at. And what did they see? What was the impression they carried away looking at this over and over again? What stayed with them? What changed forever for many people? Their risk assessment and the way they decided to live their lives. When I finally did get on a plane, I was flying from St. Louis to Minneapolis. It's the only time I've ever gotten on, and this was a pretty big plane. It was a 767, and had the flight attendant say, sit anywhere you want. There were only 9 of us. So there was no business class, unfortunately, on that plane. Where did we sit, the nine of us? Where did we sit?
Together.
Yes, we all sat together. Window aisle on each side toward the front of the plane. And also, unlike any other flight I've ever had, and I've had a lot, everyone talked to everyone. And we all said, where were you? And where are you going now? And all of those people, except for me, said, when I get home, I am never flying again. They saw planes. They saw planes. That's what made an impression on their minds. Planes. People died on planes. Therefore, I am never flying again. So what did they do? It's not that they stayed home. They still took vacations. They went on trips. How did they get there if they weren't flying? They got behind the wheel of a car and drove. And what we noticed was, yes, the number of people flying went down. The number of people driving went up. And along with all those people who were driving, increased the number of accidents, increasing the number of fatalities. So that what we noticed at the end of the first year was an increase of 800 extra people died because of the decision based on poor risk assessment. All those people who were afraid to fly killed 800 more people. That is three times the number of people who were killed on the four planes. I often wonder, is this what the terrorists had in mind? The meeting was something like this. I've got a great idea. We'll fly these planes into the World Trade Center. Then the Americans will be so afraid of flying, they'll start driving and they'll kill each other off. Wow! What a great idea. And we did it. What is it that makes people afraid? Flying is the safest mode of travel we have. I went to hear that great talk on the 777 airplane because I worked on an airplane. And I still fly. People who smoke say, well, I know that, yes, okay, the average life expectancy reduction for smoking is 5 years, but I'm still afraid to fly, but I'm not going to give up smoking. Average life expectancy reduction for flying is about 1 day. We're not very good at assessing risk in our own lives. You know, why is it that we keep thinking we're going to win the lottery? Look at the odds. I can't even count the number of zeros there. Look at that. Greater than having a heart attack. Whereas I don't have to watch my diet. I'm not going to have a heart attack, but I am going to win that big Powerball lottery. So what the psychologists tell us is that we are afraid of certain things. The stuff we inherited from our Stone Age ancestors. We don't like heights. We don't like the idea of being enclosed in a metal tube. We just don't like that. And we will never like it. We don't like the sense of loss of control. Somehow sitting behind the wheel of a car enables us to feel in control when we are not. Whereas sitting in an airplane, we have a feeling of total loss of control. What's immediate? Anytime there's a serious airplane incident, including 9/11, those of us who saw those pictures will carry those images with us forever. We'll never forget that. So when we think about flying, that's what comes to mind, those images. It makes it very available to us. They always interview the big Powerball lottery winners. That's the image we have in our heads of someone winning an enormous amount of money. Whereas if they spent the same amount of time interviewing all the losers, we'd still be sitting here watching for years while they said, tell us what it's like to lose your money in Powerball. Well, I can tell you it didn't really feel very good. But no, they don't do that. So it fits our way of looking at risk, what we're hardwired to fear, what we can't control. What's most immediate? What's most available in memory? And that affects our ability to do rational estimation. We like to think that when we start an estimate, we come to the table and we begin with a blank sheet of paper. And in reality, what happens is everybody brings to that table a set of fears that's personal, that's based on their own experience, and it interferes with our ability to think rationally about anything. It's based on our own experience and our own set of, well, I call them filters. We filter all the information that's available to us, including objective data, so that we see what we want to see, we hear what we want to hear, we read what we want to read, and we ignore the rest. So here's my favorite experiment about that particular facet of the way our brain works. It has to do with groups of people who have violent disagreement about something. No shortage of subjects there. So let's take two groups of people that disagree violently on some subject, and we will give both groups the same paper to read that has objective data, information about this subject. And what this experiment that's been repeated any number of times, which is another thing the psychologists do, they will tweak it and repeat it, tweak it and repeat it. What we see in all variations of this experiment is that at the end, when both groups have read the same paper, is that they will say, this paper supports my point of view. How is that possible? They disagree violently on some subject. This paper has data. Numbers. How is it possible that both groups can say this paper supports my point of view? How can that happen? It must be something to do with those people. Surely that wouldn't work for you. I like this quote from George Costanza. It's not a lie if you believe it. Which is, of course, our way around it. Is that we are deceiving ourselves about the risks that we face, but we really believe it. So therefore, it must be true. Well, those people in the experiment, surely they believed it. They weren't just saying this paper supports my point of view. They truly believed it. How is that possible unless we have the ability to see what we want to see, and if there's something there that we're uncomfortable with, we just simply ignore it. So we can just filter everything, ignore the stuff that makes us feel uncomfortable, and then simply say, I believe this paper supports my point of view. This data supports my point of view. So we all have this tendency. And we all have this optimism, this streak of optimism that we brought with us from the Stone Age. And it definitely interferes with our ability to do estimates. It's impossible. It's impossible for us to make a rational estimate. Because of what we bring to the table, because of the way we view risks, because of the things we tend to ignore, it's impossible. I took this clip from a paper, A Strong Tendency to Ignore Previous Feedback and Persist in Overconfidence in Their Own Estimates have been observed in software development. This is probably other people. So before I became a computer scientist, I was a mathematician. So I was really excited. My PhD has to do with design metrics. And it always happened that when I was hired to work for a company, they just saw the metrics part, skipped over the design, and I got thrown into the process people's domain. And they said, well, you can talk about other kinds of metrics. And that includes estimation. We collect all kinds of metrics about estimation. So in one particular company, there was the sense that since we had a long history of producing software successfully, that what we should do is look at data, numbers. And surely with all of the fancy estimation tools out there, very expensive, by the way, require training, by the way, you got to send somebody off to another state for a couple of weeks to learn how to use these tools. Anybody ever have that experience working with a real complicated estimation tool? It is exciting because if they know that you understand a little mathematics, they will open the hood and you can have a look. Wow, look at all those formulas. Look at all that stuff flying around. It's got to be good. And if you don't have data, if you don't have history, not to worry. Because the tool will provide you custom made, depending upon your domain, depending upon the sizes of the projects you do, we can tailor the data that's used in the estimation tool until you develop your own data set. Doesn't that sound wonderful? Won't that solve all our problems? After all, isn't that the case that what we really need to solve all our problems is just better tools and more data? I was really disappointed. It was no better at producing estimates than, well, you know what this means? Wet finger in the wind. It was no better. And think of the money, the investment of time and energy to get no better result. Ooh, I should have done a poll. Any of you working on estimation tools here? It was hard for me to accept that mathematics would not save us. I hope you're not too discouraged at this point. I've just told you that you're not a rational person and the data is not the way. It gets worse. This is a paper about managers. I won't do a poll. This is a paper about managers and estimation and how to manage projects. And in the course of running several scenarios, managers were asked to make decisions that had to do with how they would run a complicated project that went astray. I always wondered why managers don't either seem to be familiar with or don't seem to understand Brooks' Law. So I'll just, anybody familiar with Brooks' Law? One person? Two people? Three? Okay, Brooks' Law comes from the Mythical Man Month. Those of us who are authors would love to have a book that lived as long as the Mythical Man Month. It's already had its 25th anniversary, and we still haven't learned Brooks' Law. So anybody who raised a hand, can you tell us what Brooks' Law is? Yes, adding people to a late project makes it later. However, and this is, of course, other people, not you. Other people, when faced with a late project, what's the first thing they do? They add more people. So I always wondered why that is. So I asked a friend of mine who's a manager, I said, Dave, why is it that that's your first response? And he said, well, Linda, I understand Brooks' Law. But my boss I said, okay, Dave, but you know, I just read this paper, and the managers who were in the experiment managing a very complicated project that went astray, that started to get late, the first thing they did was add more people, and then they did a little debrief at the end of the experiment. And the managers who were involved all said, oh, yes, that was not a good decision. We see that. Yes, there were other things we could do, and they brainstormed. What other tactics could we have used to help this project? And then they ran another scenario, another complicated project where things went wrong and the project got late. And what happened? We had just had the brainstorming. We'd just gone through all of the other things that could have been done. So what did the managers do? Yeah, they added more people. So what the cognitive scientists tell us is that we can know at a certain level the way things should be done or could be done. But in the heat of battle, when we're under a lot of stress, we forget and we fall back on doing the same old thing. Not your projects. These are other people who have this problem. So clearly, we need another way. Is there anything that will help us? One thing we know about estimates is that we have to be clearer when we use them, because most of the time an estimate is a number. And as a former mathematician, it's very disturbing to me to see an estimate, which is, yes, it is a number, but it is not a number that has certain properties. And it's handed over to someone else who then begins to do things like add, subtract, multiply, divide. And those are operations that are only valid for certain categories of numbers. An estimate is a number, but it doesn't have those properties. It's produced by a different part of the brain. Numbers that have those properties follow certain rules. And when we add, subtract, multiply, and divide, people who know anything about statistics will say you can only do that for numbers that have certain properties. And the pathways in our brain that do those operations are located in a very specific part of the brain, the pre and frontal cortex. Follow the rules. Do this. Estimation involves reflection, consideration of the past, assessment of risk for the future. It is a very different process. It operates in a different part of the brain, and the number that is produced does not follow the rules of ordinary arithmetic. So if nothing else, we could begin to use something else. Let's stop using numbers, and it will eliminate that problem. It will not say to the person who receives that number, this is a number that you can add, subtract, multiply, or divide. Find another way. Use t-shirt sizes, small, medium, large, or gummy bears, or some. Get away from numbers, and it will at least address this problem. So you knew I was going to get around to this, right? There is no hope for estimates. I didn't promise that. There is no way to predict the future. Remember the quote from two previous slides, there are no facts. There is no way that you can say what you will do tomorrow. Your best hope is to give a true estimate and to say, I can only tell you about a small piece of this enormous problem with some certainty. And then at the end of the day, I can tell you the next small piece. There are so many good things about Agile, and this is one of them. That we don't claim to be able to make an estimate for 6 months or years, as is the case for most of my development history, which was done on enormous projects in avionics, in defense, in communications, where the timeline stretched out for 2, 3, 4, 5 years? How could anyone claim to speak about what was going to happen that far out? So what Agile has done is brought some sanity to the process to say that is impossible. Let's be honest about it. We bring our own biases to the table. Let's be honest about that. The only way we're going to have anything like success is to say, I can maybe tell you a little bit about the next step. And then we will evaluate. We will do a retrospective, which simply means we're going to think about it. And we're going to look at everything, including the estimates. And then we'll have a somewhat better idea of what we're going to do in the next small step. Now, you will never get it right. I know some Agile teams who somehow believe that it's like that tangential line in the log curve. You're approaching that asymptote, and you're going to get closer and closer and closer. No, I'm sorry. Your estimates may not improve. You hope that they get better over time, but they may not. Don't delude yourselves into believing that Agile is going to make you a perfect estimator. What it promises is that you're not going to delude yourself or others to any greater extent than you have to say, all I can say is what the next iteration, the next 2 weeks, if Bob Martin likes 2 weeks, that works for me, what the next 2 weeks possibly are going to be like. And that's it.
Thanks to Linda Rising for allowing us to publish her ETE 2010 talk. You can hear other ETE sessions by heading over to the techcast.chariotsolutions.com website and selecting conference sessions from the list of podcast categories. While you're there, explore our regular developer news and TechCast sessions, as well as our new business podcasts. We had production help this week from Mike Richardson. Our podcast themes are free theme number 3 and number 4 from podcastthemes.com. The show and Philly Emerging Technologies is supported and sponsored by Chariot Solutions. Visit www.chariotsolutions.com for more information about our services, including mobile, web, and integration application development, mentoring, and education services. For the TechCast, I'm Ken Rimple.